Are you struggling to find the right professional talent for your project? Are you working with a limited budget?
We are so excited about our next sponsor, Casting Networks. I have personally used Casting Networks to release a number of projects for free to the industry's largest network of professional performers for my commercial work and for my very first short film, Strange Thing.
Creators can manage submissions, schedule auditions, request and review self-tapes, and book top talent for their projects, all in one place. All for free.
On Casting Networks, you can create an account and send your casting call to thousands of professional talent. So join Casting Networks, the industry's preferred casting platform where more than 1.2 million performers have scheduled over 14 million auditions. That's a lot of auditions. Visit www.castingnetworks.com/movies to create an account for free today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Pacell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, will be coming out on September 13th. Woo!
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Speed of Life and Bread and Butter. I'm currently in development on 3,000 more. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we have the Addams Family on the show to talk about their latest horror feature, Hellbender. They talk about how success has impacted their lives as filmmakers and how they managed to make movies as a family. After that, Alric and I read an iTunes review and we chat about our filmmaking process. But first, Alric, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I've been like chipping away at some writing this week. I mean, like not every day or anything, but like I think 2 to 3 times. Like one time I actually sat down with my laptop and I wrote words into my computer, which was great.
Oh.
And then another time I was on my phone typing words into my little, you know, my note app I use. So it was kind of more like plotting and planning and not actually writing. But I think what I discovered for myself, or I realized, is that I need to write a scene that I really care about in the movie in order to really get me going. Because like I started writing like the opening, and the opening is very challenging of this movie. It's just really like a technical sort of exercise of trying to figure out like how I'm telling the story in this very different way. But it's like so hard that it's like keeping me from like really moving. And I remember with The Alternate, I wrote the end of the movie first. Like I just wrote the end scene and it just flew out of me. And then like once that scene was out, like I was able to like write back to the end of the movie. And I think I need to do the same thing here. Although I don't think for this movie, it's going to be the end. I think it's going to be like the middle. Like there's a scene in the middle of the movie that was like the first thing I thought of when I thought of the movie when it came to me months ago. And so I think like that scene, writing that scene out, and like having it all just on paper, even just the first draft of it, will help like get me excited to solve some of the problems in the earlier part of the script, or just at least get it onto paper and then just go, you know, because I think getting that first draft out for me is really important. Like I'm not like, what was that guy? Riley Stearns.
Yeah.
Who's like, I note and note. And then the draft you shoot is the first draft. It's like, that's just... It's just not me. I have to have iteration in order for me to like get my ideas, you know, to make sense. And it has to be in script form. But I mean, at least that's what it's been so far. I mean, maybe I could do what Riley does one day, but I don't know. So it was kind of fun. It was like a little revelation that I had this week that I have to, that's what I should do. So now I'm like, okay, I got to write that scene. But yeah, I'm well. How are you, Liz?
I'm hesitant to tell you my update because I feel like I know what you're going to say. I have an idea for another project. I'm just waiting for you to be like, that's too many projects, Liz.
Okay. Is it a Busby Berkeley underwater musical number short film? Is that what you're thinking of next? Okay.
So I'm still working on the musical. I'm still working on this proof of concept short for the musical. And then I have the horror feature I'm writing. And then I have these projects I'm attached to, right? So I'm only actively like creating two real things right now. But I've been talking to my husband and I think he needs like a creative boost. He needed something to work on creatively. And I was thinking, why aren't we doing a horror anthology? I had so much fun on my horror short, and Sean hasn't directed for a while, and he's a great director. And we have so many wonderful friends in the horror world. And I live next door to Andrew Schrader, who writes short stories that are all horror centric. Like, it's just like, we have all of these like wonderful connections and people who I think would want to work together for fun doing a low budget horror anthology. So that's what we're doing right now, is we're we're looking at material or writing material and we're aiming to make a horror anthology. And I think it's, I'm going to beta test crew ownership. Crew and cast ownership on this film, where everyone who's a part of it owns it. And it'll be like the beta version of this collective I want to do next year. And I think there needs to be a step between where I am now and making this horror collective. And I'm still writing it, right? Like, it's not even ready, but I'm just so excited to make content. And I had so much fun in this horror short. So I'm thinking of putting together an anthology right now.
So are you writing all the shorts, or is someone else writing some of them? Or like, how you envision this to happen?
I'm checking out some. I reached out to Andrew Schrader, who listens to the show. So maybe he's hearing me right now. My voice is being recorded on August 2nd, but maybe on August 8th, he's hearing me. I reached out to Andrew Schrader to see if he has any material that would be appropriate. Sean is thinking of writing his own. I have a few ideas that I have in my head, and I think I'm not going to crowdsource. I'm going to like actively curate who I want to go out to and see if they have either willing to create new material or if they have like just a horror short in their back pocket. And the idea is to not be messy about it, but to have like a real vision before I go out to people. And Sean and I are trying to figure out what's the organizing idea. Like, what's, you know, what's the weird, creepy house of VHS tapes? You know, what is, what is the thing that connects everything? So we're trying to figure that out. I think right now we like the idea of doing some sort of tribute to classic horror, but we're not quite sure yet. Yeah.
Fun. Well, I'm not against this idea as much as the other ideas. I think this is a fun idea because, like, I've thought about horror anthologies or just an anthology in general, just because, you know, I've got these short films and, you know, I like making shorts and it would be fun to be a part of an anthology. But it's just like, you know, trying to make that my main project, it seems like not the right thing. But my friend, he was thinking about doing an anthology and he was tossing around ideas for that. But yeah, what, if you need another director.
Ulrich, that would be pretty cool. That would be pretty cool. I'm not gonna lie.
I raise my hand. Everyone listening to this is raising their hand right now. So I know you're going to have a lot of people who are going to be like, Liz, oh, I would love to direct something. Ah, I have 10 shorts. Which one do you want to put in your anthology? Like, you know, but are you looking for existing content or do you want to create new, only brand new, fresh content?
I'm not quite sure, but because, you know, it's not like I'm making millions of dollars and Sean's unemployed right now. So I think the focus is resources and access and local right now. Like, I don't think, like, we want to be very thoughtful in how we curate each short, but it's also like, I like the idea of Sean and I making these while Colin's at daycare. Like, I don't think we have the flexibility to put together a production schedule where we could just do whatever we want. I think we have to do, like, I don't think we could pay for a babysitter while we make this. So I'm thinking, well, what if we figure out ideas or sets or sceneries that we can work on, while he's at daycare, while Sean's unemployed, so that we're productive. And then the idea is like, maybe Sean would edit it, you know.
And would you do, like, would you be looking for teams who would, like, operate autonomously on their own? Or are you only looking for teams where, like, you and Sean are going to be, like, on set with them, like, part of the creation, the creative process, like, in the shorts?
I haven't figured it out yet because, honestly, I thought it was just going to be me and Sean doing the anthology. And then we were like, wait, but we have so many wonderful friends and colleagues who would make this better. And that's where we are. We're at the, like, beginning of, like, who do we loop in? And this is actually all inspired by Emily Higgins. I had lunch with her last week. Emily Higgins, former guest of the show. And she was like, you know, I don't think there's been a lot of female directed horror anthologies. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And she was part of Scare Package. And, you know, she's done the horror anthology thing. And she's one of my mentors. Anyway, she inspired me just to even open myself up to the idea. So right now we don't know if it's me and Sean directing the whole thing or if we're really going to open it out.
Going out to other people.
But I think we'll open
it. Or if you're
going
to go to women only too, because that could be another thing fun if it was like all women directors.
It's all women and then Sean. Like, Sean is like the only man.
Sean's the token male.
Token dude, yeah.
That would be really great because, like, you know, like, I mean, I think Emily was the token woman in Scare Package. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it'd be funny. And there's always like, they always try to like work at least one woman into these, which is great that they do it. But it would be so refresh if it was the other way around where it's like, oh, it's all women. And then they worked in one guy.
Through nepotism. He got in through nepotism.
Exactly. That's so funny. Well, that sounds like fun.
Well, thank you. But do you know what's more fun?
What's more fun?
Supporting us on Patreon. That's right. Head on over to www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. Every single dollar that you give to contribute to the show makes the show way better. Like way better. Like just like monumentally, exponentially better. You could like dramatically make the show higher quality.
We care more if you, the more money you put in, basically.
Care more. It sounds better. Everything just gets better. Without any more delay, here's our chat with John Adams and Toby Poser of the Adams Family. Can you give everyone in the world the elevator pitch for Hellbender?
Hellbender is a coming of witch tale about a daughter and mother who live on an isolated mountaintop, casting spells with their rock band into the ether. And there's a little more to their lonely existence than the daughter knows.
And how many days did you shoot the film?
We took basically a year to shoot this film. Since we're a tiny little family that shoots films, we don't have a schedule. So from beginning to end, this took a year.
I have so many questions.
More that. Questions.
What was the rough budget?
About the size of your pinky.
Less than a producer's suit in Hollywood. Like a cheap producer, too. Like, you know.
Like a nice cheap polyester suit that just you can wear forever.
But it's cool. We like polyester suits. But we still can't afford one. So how's that for like roundabout answer?
That's a good answer, actually. It's more detail than we get. Are you kidding me? No one tells us anything.
So under $100,000 is what I'm hearing. Amazing.
Our budget really was $14,000.
About that, yeah.
Yeah, $14,000.
Wow. Amazing, guys. Incredible.
We were told never to answer that question, but I don't really understand why we're never supposed to answer that question, because it's
once it's sold, it doesn't matter.
So it's $14,000. That's what it cost.
Nice. So yeah, the next question was, how did you guys come up with the idea?
Well, two things. We have our band Hellbender, but the E's are sixes, and that preceded the movie Hellbender with the E's. We were starting to make a music video for our song Black Sky, and it was just super witchy, and all these themes were kind of just falling from the clouds or trickling up from hell, whichever way you want to look at it. And we thought, man, we got to explore this further and really let's define what this concept of Hellbender is.
And also, after we made The Deeper You Dig, people really said that they loved the relationship between the mother and the daughter, and they would have loved to have seen more of that. So we were like, great, we can do that. That's something we can do. So we definitely wanted to make a movie about a mother and a daughter.
And I'll add one other thing just to make it a triplet. I had found out a couple years ago that I was donor conceived, and I learned this at age 50, and that was just pretty mind-blowing. So of course that gets your wheels turning, like, well, who the hell is my biological dad? And of course we had fun thinking, well, what if he was like, you know, killing children on the, you know, in the corners of a sidewalk, you know, alley, or you know.
Actually, we wondered whether he was the devil.
And then, well, that's what we got to, and then that led us to maybe he could be the devil, and then that just really turned into this sort of motif that we wanted to follow of, you know, nature and nurture. Because I have all these new siblings, half siblings, and we are so much more alike than the brother I was raised, I was nurtured with, and who I'm not biologically related to. So that was really fun to explore.
And it was kind of wild to think about. This movie started out as The Devil's Daughter. That was the original name of it. So we started thinking that this was going to be about the devil's daughter, but the devil is way too huge of a concept to conquer on $14,000. So you need $14 billion to do a devil movie. So we did. We stripped it down to pieces of the devil.
Wow.
You talked about production being a year. How long did you spend working on the film from coming up with the idea until now, essentially?
We work every day on our films. Our life, like our regular life and our filmmaking now at this point are kind of the same thing. Like I eat breakfast in front of, like I edit or do music while I'm eating breakfast. Toby writes. There's Zelda is taking photos. Like it's pretty hard to separate our films from our life. So we work every day on it. But it's not work, it's fun. So it's kind of different than maybe most people make movies.
Compared to all the other projects you've made, how difficult was it to make this one?
I would say not difficult. I mean, this was during the pandemic, But that it, for us, it kind of, that was okay because, you know, we can work together. The three, the core, you know, main characters and John, who had a small character in this, that didn't affect us. Our older daughter, Lulu, who plays Amber in the film, we actually were social distancing from her because we got a little time with her. She was living out in Portland and we were traveling a lot during the making of this film. And so that was a little funny and challenging to do the little social distance with her because she was working in a school and this was pre-vaccination era. But it otherwise, helped. It was pure joy and not hard.
Even that helped because it makes their relationship awkward. Like they had an awkward time. They're sisters. They hug each other. They do everything together. And in this movie, obviously, it's supposed to be a very awkward, strange relationship. So it really helped. I love their relationship in the movie.
Hmm. Ulrich and I are both newer parents. We're both micro-budget filmmakers, for what it's worth, separately. And so part of the reason I was so excited to talk to you is because I think you live an ideal life where you incorporate family and art together. Can you, this is, I always ask questions that are way too big to answer in like 2 minutes, but how, teach me how to do, how can I do that? How can I bring my three-year-old into the fold right now?
That's so fun. You're so lucky.
I know my answer. Three-year-old. Yeah,
that start. Was,
it's
start
like, oh my God.
Pour blood all over the baby.
Right?
Get a camera.
Yeah. I think
having, don't tell your friends. That's how you start.
Or use them.
Yeah, right. Tell your cool friends.
If you have a camera that's easy to, and it's always kind of with you, and your kid is always with you, I say you just start doing it. I mean, a lot of our best stuff that we capture is just because we're so mobile. And we're so portable. And we'll see something outside our window and we have the three of us or the two of us or the one of us and we have the camera with us or our house is nearby and we just go for it because that cloud is only going to stick around so long and that storm is only going to pass quickly. So I think you just start doing it.
And as like one of the things that we love about raising our kids, they're kind of leaving now, but we were always just friends with them. And so like I wasn't raised in an environment that was definitely like equal to your parents. And it was really important to us that our kids were just equal. So they're, if that makes any sense, they were our friends and they were equals. And so like very early on, like at age 6, when we were making our first movie and Lulu was 11, their opinions really mattered. And it really mattered if they asked us to do something that we did it, to prove to them that their opinion mattered. And now I think they're both strong artists because they value their own opinion.
And I realize that I bring in a little bit more context because I've done a bunch of research on y'all. But can you set up the fact of like your filmmaking history as a family just in a way that's more objective than me just asking a question that's really charged with making you change my life?
All of us decided at the same time that we really wanted to make a movie. All of us at the moment were slightly unsuccessful at our dreams. So the four of us together bought an RV and started out making movies. And we learned so much on that first movie. If we had known how much we needed to learn, we wouldn't have done it. But we were so ignorant, each of us, that we did do it. And it's a weird little movie. And then from that, we learned we loved it. We made mistakes. So we tried to fix those mistakes. We tried to do what we did well again. And then we just continued doing that because each movie just became more and more and more and more fun.
I have so many freaking questions. I'm trying to like figure out where to start. But I think let's just start with the things you learned on the first movie. Like what were some of the things that you did wrong that you corrected for the next project?
It's funny. When we showed our edit of the first film, which was called Rumble Strips, to two filmmakers, and they said, it's very French. And I think they're saying
it just
was really a lot of long, you know, languorous pauses. And that's because you love your material so much. We've, over the years, we've learned to cut more and to ditch those babies that you kind of love, but that don't feed the story. That's one thing.
Well, I agree with you. I think we're trying to get to the point quicker. We're trying to find the kernel of why a scene is there and trying to get to it quickly. Sometimes it's important that you drag things out sometimes, but you got to be, or we feel like we have to be very careful about that.
I'll say one other thing though. Sometimes it's easy to think of like, what did you learn not to do? But it's also really important to remember the things that work. Like in that first film, because we were ignorant, we were capturing so many things because of the feeling. And maybe structurally, they don't make sense if you were to look at like an outline or typical, you know, filmmaking structures. But when you know your story so well, those little tiny moments, you don't want to ignore. And I think we still try to capture things that might not structurally make sense, but that emotionally just completely like feed that story more than anything that makes sense could. And I never want to lose that creativity to do something that kind of goes against the rules, but just feels so right.
On the topic of iterating, you said earlier that some fans said that they wanted to hear more about the mother-daughter relationship. So you changed Hellbender to focus more on mother-daughter. How do you interact with your fan? Like, do you have a newsletter? Is it social media? Is it just sending links out to friends? Like, how are you actually being informed by your audience?
We read audience reviews. We read reviewer reviews. We are very active on social media. We love talking to people. We love people's opinions. We learn so much. And festivals. Festivals are amazing because you're sitting in a theater with an audience and then it's done and then you're talking to them and you're learning so much. It's so wonderful to watch a movie with other people because you just learn so much about what you've done.
Okay, so when you made your first movie, you're saying one kid was 11 and one was 6. What did you guys do? Like, was it in the summer break when there was no school? Like, did you just, how was that solved? Like, with, you know, their lives and your lives to go off and just make a movie?
They never got an education. No, I'm kidding.
They had the education. We called it road school, literally, because we got an RV. And yeah, we got this old RV and we just took off for a year and we homeschooled them. One kid was in first grade and the other was in sixth grade. And yeah, we just homeschooled. It was fun.
And you said that was a decision that the four of you made. So you all sat down as a family and you're like, this is something that we can do. Are you all in? And then everybody decided, yeah, let's no more school. Let's go do school differently. Let's go off and make a movie on the road as a family. That's incredible.
It was fun. Actually, there is a YouTube video that was shot maybe a day or two after we all decided to do it. And you can see each of us has our own reasons that this is a great idea. And the girls' reasons are really funny.
That's amazing. Wow.
How do you set up the economics of that? Are you saving years in advance and you have this idea in your mind that you're going to kind of check in with your kids about? Or is it improvised as you go?
Well, I mean, we usually kind of make a film with what we kind of have in our pockets. We've never crowdfunded. In fact, the movie we're working on right now is the first time we've gotten money from people who want to invest in the film, that it's not like our money. But usually it's like what we have at our fingertips, we know we can make a film with.
Yeah, I mean, for like The Deeper You Dig, we were really hurting for money. And I was redoing an old house. So we shot the film in the old house while I was making, you know, $25 an hour. And that was the budget at that time. When we made our first movie, Rumble Strips, Toby had been doing really well doing voiceovers. But it turned out that it would be cheaper for us to live in an RV and drive around the country than it was to pay rent in Los Angeles. So it was kind of like, well, let's do that. That sounds more fun. So both of those were just kind of like, we really want to do art. So how can we do art with the money in our pants?
And then I think Wow. You also asked too, Liz, I mean, like a lot of it we are figuring out along the way.
Yeah.
I mean, we rarely have a set script. And if we do, sometimes we maybe have a template of a scene, but it's just a jumping off point. Really, once we start going through the motions, we realize what a film is about or isn't about. And we often reshoot the stuff. So a lot of it is really like, hey, it's coming together. It's building itself while we're making it. That just works for us.
So you on your other projects, you haven't had like a full script from start to finish that's like the movie before you start? You just like have some scenes and like a rough outline and you just go and make it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. That's beautiful.
It's fun because a lot of scenes need, well, at least for us, a lot of scenes need to explain themselves to you.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we'll shoot things 3 or 4 times. Like we'll just keep going back because we'll bring it home and we'll look at it and we'll be like, oh my God. I got what we got to say. Like, this is really what's important about this scene. And then we'll go back and we'll go get that thing. And that is what's nice about the family dynamic is we're all just sitting around. So
okay, I have to kind of hear this sort of answer to this question. It's going to be a weird question, but basically like from the first movie to the next movie, to the next movie, to the next movie, like what did your lives like look like through that time? Like, is it kind of like a variation of like the RV, we're all making a movie, homeschooling the kids, or has it changed? Like, have they gone back to school and then come out of school again? Like, what has that progression been like since you started making movies?
Great question.
Yeah, they've been in school. We did homeschool another spell, but I think Lulu was already in college. So when Zelda was in seventh grade, we homeschooled again because we were traveling around with The Deeper You Dig, maybe. But yeah, no, we just, you know, a lot of our best business meetings are on the way to soccer practice because we live in the middle of nowhere. So we're in the car a lot.
Okay, yeah, but then soccer actually, Zelda actually got hurt, so she couldn't play soccer. So I think the quick answer to your question is that we dip in and out of normalcy, kind of. And anytime we cannot be normal and kind of travel and be more free, we'll take that opportunity. And that's why COVID was like painful for the world. But for us, it was like, oh, well, Zelda's not going to go to school, so we don't need to sit in this house. We could sit in a trailer all over the United States. So our choice would be to drift. But there's been times where it's important, like, I think it's been important for the kids to like go to school or something, you know.
I know that you mentioned that you're all equals, which I love as a way to raise a family. But in terms of like a film set, it's very hard to have a completely horizontal film set, right? So can you talk a little bit about how power dynamics come into play just in final decision making?
We shoot three ways if there's three opinions and we don't argue about it. We just shoot it. Like, even as outlandish as somebody's opinion may be, you shoot it because arguments on set are just burning up cloud time. So it's like, we just shoot it. And then we come home, and I would say 100% of the time, the editing bay solves the argument or the discussion.
Wow. And where are you guys based out of now?
We're in the Catskill Mountains, upstate New York.
Oh, wow. Okay. East Coast. Amazing. So when you say burning up cloud time, is that referring to like you prefer to shoot while it's overcast because need as much lighting? Is that okay? Cool.
Yeah, if we were going to ever make a documentary, it's going to be called Waiting on a Cloud, because we sit around and we wait for clouds because we only shoot in flat light because we only use natural light, and flat light just looks, we're just in love with flat light.
So this rolls into one of the other questions I wanted to ask because I'm sure a lot of people are out there like saying, this sounds incredible. Like, oh my God, like I want to be able to do what these guys are doing. So the question is, what is your gear? Like, what is your system? What gear do you have? Like, you already talked about no lighting, which is awesome. But how do you guys run the set with like the actual equipment and everything?
Tripod, Canon 5D, 2 zooms, 2 mics. Oh, and 2 mic stands, and that's it. Oh, well, no, that's not true. Actually, on this latest movie, we bought a Ronin and we bought a drone. So we added those because it was really important to Zelda to get moving. She was a little frustrated with our static shots and she really wanted to bring motion into our film. So we got her a Ronin and we got her a drone, and she operated both of those and she did a really good job. And she definitely added a really important dimension to our movies by bringing those in.
Wow.
I'm curious, when you work with the system, like when you work with the establishment, so to speak, like, do you always hire a publicist? Do you ever hire a sales agent? I mean, I understand you work with film festivals, and I don't mean to set up a picture that you guys are on the outskirts of society or something, but you're so truly independent that I want to see how gatekeepers come into play in your life at all.
Such a great question. Awesome.
Sure. You know, with our last film, with the film before Hellbender called The Deeper You Dig, we, from the festival circuit that we were doing on our own, we were approached by a number of sales agents, and we ended up going with one, and we thought, okay, this is a cool, and that was MPI Media Group, and then the film was distributed through Dark Sky. And for Hellbender, we thought we'd be really good. We liked that method of going with a sales agent because I don't think that was something that we'd be able to do so well on our own. We'd been distributing on Amazon, basically all our films before that. And then we thought that Yellow Veil Pictures would be a great fit for Hellbender. And we absolutely fell in love with that trio of guys. And they understood us and they understood the film. So we were thrilled to go that route with them. And then they introduced us to Shudder. And we just have been like, we were just talking this morning saying, my God, it's just, you could replicate that every day of your life that you make a film. It's just gone so smoothly. So it's been very, very positive for us, who's used to doing everything on our own, to be with people who we actually feel safe in their hands. We trust them so much, and to, you know, find the perfect place for the film.
And it's really great when we find people like Yellow Veil and like Shudder. They do respect that we're just a tiny little family. So they're not trying to change the dynamic. They're not giving advice about how to get bigger and things like that. And we notice when we do operate with gatekeepers, like you're saying, that are like, hey, we can change your dynamic and make you big and famous or things like that. It's kind of like, that's not what we want. And so we're like, oh, thanks. That's really cool. But that's not really who we're wanting. That's not what we want.
Yeah. And to your publicity question too, you know, that's something that we also had been doing on our own before, and then being introduced to people who are really a great fit in that sense as well, which we also found through Yellow Veil, Kayla, and then AMC and now Falco. I mean, it's like, oh my God, it feels, I can't tell you how good it feels to be with a team, a PR team that, you know, just gets it done. Yeah. and responds and gets you out. I mean, it's just been a pleasure.
I got to add one more really important thing about, because this is the best question of all. I just love this question, is that when a genuine gatekeeper comes along, like Mitch Davis from Fantasia Film Festival, we are absolutely the tiniest nobodies ever. And we sent him our film and he wrote back and he brought us to Fantasia with The Deeper You Dig. And he was a gatekeeper who just opened the door and was like, hey, welcome into the room. And it totally changed our lives and blew us away. And it was just this genuine guy and a genuine festival. So any filmmakers out there, there are festivals that are so genuine that you want to be a part of.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, how have your lives changed since you had your first movie premiere at Fantasia? Like, what was the result of that?
Massive. He changed our life, because before we were just clawing our way kind of in the darkness, and he just opened a door, and sorry about all the dumb metaphors, but suddenly there was some light in the room, and it was like, oh my God, and we got a chance to breathe, and suddenly we were talking to the right people, and that mostly is like fans and other people, like people, suddenly he brought us an audience that we didn't know we had. So it's just massively important. And if you're making horror, I don't know whether you guys make horror or drama or what.
We both do. Yeah.
Yeah. Horror, sci-fi.
If you make horror, the horror community is wonderful. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to love everything that you do, but they probably are going to watch it, and they're going to comment on it, and they're going to respect it. And that's massive.
So I'm dying to know or talk more about like this thing that you said earlier, where you're like, okay, like we don't want to get rich and famous, like we don't want to change our dynamic. What is that referring to? Like are there opportunities where like you'd have to change your style in order to like take the opportunity?
Yeah.
Or like, is there something specific? Like, can I give more light onto what you mean there?
Well, we won't get specific, but when an offer rolls through that says, like, yes, will you work with this crew and shoot this kind of movie? And here's the script. And we read it and we're like, oh my God, like, with all due respect to the people that have put that together and the producers and the writers and everything, it's not what we want to do. Like, we worked so hard for 10 years all by ourselves. And then, I don't know, someone, basically they're asking you to work. Like, here's your job and here's what you get paid. And it's kind of like, yeah, but I mean, we ate peanut butter and jelly sandwiches so that we wouldn't have to work. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, like you don't want to be beholden to anybody. Like, you're trying to just make your movies in your style with your family, and you want someone to support that, but you're not trying to like come in and like direct, well, let's just use a Marvel movie or something. Like, that's like not what you're wanting to do.
And I love watching Marvel movies, but I don't really want to direct one. It looks like a very tedious, hard job. That does not look fun to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they make a lot of money. Also, Toby and I are like in our 50s, like the whole fame and kind of stuff like that isn't as alluring as it maybe once was a long time ago. At this point, it's more like, it's really nice to like, well, here we are talking to you, we're hanging out. It's like fun. It's fun. It's really great. This is good.
Well, to that point, then what are the ambitions? Are there ambitions beyond where you are right now?
I think we're figuring a lot of stuff out right now. I think our ambition, I think I speak for both of us when I say we want to keep loving what we're doing. And if that means working, collaborating with others, we'll figure that out.
Yeah.
There's no reason why we can't try working with others and playing in other sandboxes, but still always have our Addams Family Wonder Wheel Productions joint, which is just like us and weird and, you know, and completely unconventional. We're trying to figure it out. But the key, I think, is to keep loving what we've been doing and just what we've been doing from the get-go, kind of being able to live a fun life, like Don just said, but still do our art and continuing that kind of symbiotic, that beautiful symbiotic creature that we've been able to enjoy sounds good to me.
And we'd just like to get better. Like, we would like to, each movie, we want to be better. We want to be better storytellers and better filmmakers.
Let's talk about this next project that you're working on, because you said this is the first time that you've gone with a budget, you know, bigger than what you, like, well, money from someone else, let's say. How is that changing what you're doing or evolving your style as filmmakers? And what are you trying to accomplish with that this new way of working, I should say?
Great question.
Yeah, and it's funny because not much has changed as far as how we work. It's just we have a little bit more resources. Like in the current film we're doing, it takes place in the 1930s on a dying carnival circuit. So yeah, that means you need to build sets. You need to have costumes. You need to hire people who attend the carnival. It's a new kind of challenge for us. And so we've had some more money to do that, to outfit people, to pay actors. But as far as the style of how we're making it, it's very much the same.
Yeah, it's just that now we can, like, we don't have to duct tape everything together. We can actually screw things together. It's like our, like, we get, that's like our production. Yes, it's really cool to be able to buy like 2x4s and stuff instead of go find sticks to, you know, I know that sounds really weird, but we're buying 2x4s and plywood and things. And it's like
recycling
helpful.
Them, like, yes. Big time. Like, John's building these awesome, like, carnival sets and just learning ways to recycle them so we can use the same material to just build another set or to shoot behind that set, because we realized, oh, that's kind of more interesting than even the front of the carnival. It's right. The backstage that's even more gritty and interesting.
But also honoring actors. Like mostly we've always relied on family and friends to be like, would you be in our movie? You know, and they will. And, you know, we can't push them too hard, even though we do if they're our family. Like, it's nice to be able to pay somebody to say, hey, could you come be an extra in a carnival? And all you got to do is clap your hands and I can pay you. And it just makes us feel a lot better.
Gosh. Art, do we need to move to the final questions or do you want to ask?
I want to ask one more. It's kind of on the same line of things. And it's a multi-part question. So are you bringing in more crew into your productions now? No.
Yeah, the only thing that we added was two lighting guys came and helped us do one particular scene that we really needed their help with. And they did a wonderful job. And it was great to meet them. But no, we don't have a crew. Lulu was here for a while. So she helped me build sets with her boyfriend. So I guess in a sense that they were a crew.
And the guy, our wonderful Trey Lindsay, who does our computer-generated special effects, and he's also really good with, you know, practical, too. He's been there to help, and sometimes he'll shoot when we're all on camera, and it's a particularly, like, bloody, active day where we need an extra hand. He's just the most wonderful person in the world.
Yeah, unfortunately, we still aren't at the place where our budget can pay for, like, a crew where you could honorably pay people. So it's just easier for us just to do the work.
And then schedule. Are you still doing your roaming schedule, like, you know, shooting a movie over a year and not confining into like 30 days or something?
Yeah, we're still rolling schedule, letting the film tell us where it is and what we have to do. This film in particular has really, we've just run after it. It's been a pleasure to film. It's been really fun because it's kind of just told us what we need to do. It's one of those films that's just, I don't know, it has not been hard. It's been a lot of work, but it's been very easy. We just follow it. We're just, you know, it was Zelda's idea. She came up with this wonderful idea, which is basically Bonnie and Clyde meets Frankenstein with a touch of Grapes of Wrath. And it's like, this movie's just so fun to film.
Wow. And then last part of my question was, are you ever thinking about getting like bigger stars in your movies, like even supporting roles? Or are you just keeping it the same way that you've been doing all your other ones? Like, you know, just with, you know, you star as the stars or friends and family, you know, etc.
What's your answer?
It's never been top of our thought system or conversation. Sometimes we'd be like, oh my God, Patton Oswalt would be great in this role. And we just love him. And he's been so supportive. So sometimes we'll think, we'll tinker with that idea. But we've never reached out to even make that a possibility.
I think we're still a little, well, two things. One is we love working with real people. Like, real people bring something that actors just cannot. Like, for example, we just shot with two people who are in a band who are wild characters and beautiful people. And they bring something that no actor could, because they got tattoos all over their face. They're like, they've lived a certain kind of life. So there's something coming out of their eyes. Now, they might not be seasoned pro actors that you can get them in two takes, but they also don't mind hanging out for 2 days, eating lunch with us, talking shit, and then going out and trying to get that shot again. So there's these advantages in working with real people who will sit around with you until you get it. But then we do talk about it. Imagine, like, we've never, like, yeah, big famous actors. I don't know. Like, do you ask them to do something? And they just, since they're so big and famous and great, do they nail it down in one take and make your life easy? I don't know. It sounds a little bit stressful to me.
I really do feel like it all comes down to who's going to be best for the role.
Yeah.
Like, if someone who has a name might be best for it, okay, cool. But I don't think we need a name to get the point across with a certain character. It's just not that important.
One last funny thing is a lot of the time people will come up to us and say, hey, I really want to be in your movie. Can I, you know, we'll be at the grocery store. Can I be in your movie? And it'll be like, I'll look at them and I'll be like, you would be great if we could we cut your arm off? And they'd be, oh my God, I'd love to have my arm cut off. Would you guys cut my, how are you going to do it? And it'd be like with a saw. And oh, yes, I would love to do it. And so suddenly we have this enthusiastic person who's going to show up and we're going to cut their arm off with the saw. So a lot of this is like fun and it's like people in our community and it's just a good, it's good, it's good.
Oh my God, amazing. It's like an ideal life. But moving on to our final five questions. What's the first film you made and how do you feel about it now?
Ooh, nice. All right.
Rumble Strips. Love it. It was a real ignorance is bliss thing. It's visually beautiful. We shot it all across the country. We're all so young in it. I feel great about it.
I love it too. It's not when people say, what are your movies? They don't say, oh, go watch Rumble Strips because they might watch and be like, God, they really suck. They're so dumb. But it was like, it was awesome. And when I watch it, also remember that we're watching a diary of our life. So there's no way we could separate ourselves from any of our movies. They're all wonderful for some particular reason.
What's the best filmic advice that you've ever received?
You can't do that.
It's true.
Good. Watch
me. We're doing
me.
It.
Somebody said that to Toby recently, like when we said we're making a movie in the 1930s and like, oh, that's dead in the water. You can't do that. She was like, eat shit.
I'm curious what your answer of this one is. What's the worst advice you've ever received or dispensed or heard or witnessed or anything?
That you need a lot of money. Like, there's a lot of people just wait and wait and wait to make their movie because they're like, we need this amount, this size crew, this kind of equipment. And it's like, dude, you are wasting time. Just do it.
Yeah. And then recently we also had someone say, you know, the goal of this is to, you make a $1 million movie, then a $5 million, then a $10 million, then a $40 million. And he was like, that's the goal of all this. So you really need to start working a little harder towards it. And it was like, okay. That was the same guy Toby said, eat shit to. So it all worked out. We don't have that movie.
Oh my God. That is amazing. Do you have goals as filmmakers?
To get better at filmmaking and storytelling. I mean, really, that's really what I want to do. How about you?
And continue loving it. You know, sometimes you meet people and they are so stressed. And they've even said to us, God, you guys are making films like the way we used to make films. And I feel a little bad for them because it's like, okay, I know you're making stuff that maybe more people see it, but you don't sound like you're having fun. I never want to stop having fun. I really love making movies. I want to keep loving it.
That being said, we do respect the fact that there are people out there that do have fun making very expensive movies that are really successful and they make lots of money. We completely respect that. Because I like those movies. Like, I like seeing Iron Man. I'll go watch Iron Man and Thor and lots of things.
And that's what they want to do. And they want to be stressed and make movies. And that's cool. Thank you. Because I love that movie. And I never knew you were stressed because I'm seeing the movie. But when I talked to you, I realized you were stressed. And I don't want to be that stressed person.
Yeah.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you would give yourself?
Oh, I wouldn't tell myself anything.
I don't think I have an answer for that either. Because all the mistakes are so beautiful.
And then last question, is making movies hard?
As hard as you want to make it for yourself.
Hard work.
It's hard work. There you go. But again, it's like, if you like it, it's not work. It's very complicated. That's one of the things that the deeper you get into movie making, the more you realize, oh, there's a lot of complicating things here. You know, the details. When you first start making movies, it's very general. You don't see all the tiny little things. But as you make more and more and more and more movies, you realize how many tiny things go into the big picture.
Wow. I love that answer. So tell people, where should they go if they want to learn more about you? If they're like completely blown away like Liz is and completely in love with everything you're doing, yeah. Where can they go to support you guys?
Our website is wonderwheelproductions.com, and that has all of our films on it with trailers and where you can watch them. And then on Instagram, we're adams.family.films. Twitter is adams_films. And then John and I are on Facebook, Toby Poser, John Adams.
And we love talking to people.
Lulu Adams.
So let's rock.
Thank you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was really nice conversation.
Arik, what do you remember from our conversation with John and Toby?
Oh, man. Oh, they're so great. I just remember their spirit, their energy was so positive and so just full of like creativity and excitement. And like they were like living their best lives with their family. And like, I think like they figured out something that works for them and that they love to do. Right. Yeah. But like, this definitely wouldn't work for everybody. Like I'm telling my wife about this and she's like, that sounds like a nightmare. That sounds terrible. I wouldn't want to do that. And I was like, well, could be fun though. But yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from. Cause like, you know, we like our, like being in our place and, you know, just like having a routine of some kind and like, you know, whatever, like traveling across country, making a movie seems challenging. You know? But yeah, it was really, really interesting to hear their process and just to hear about like the way they approached it. It's basically kind of how like I think parts of it are how I think we should all be making our art. Like we should all just be making our art to make the art and then making the next piece of art and making the next piece of art. And then like, you know, eventually, you know, maybe we'll get recognized for that art. Maybe we won't. And it's very cool that like, you know, their work is getting recognized and getting some attention and that they're, you know, upping their game a little bit. But it's so funny, like, because one of the things that they were talking about was like the offer they had to like direct this movie and they were like repulsed by it, like didn't want to do it at all. I was like, ah, that sounds like a job. That's not what we want. That's not fun anymore. And I was like, but don't you want a directing job? Isn't that a thing that you'd want to do? So it's just so funny because I just did not connect with their base reaction to that part of their success, you know. And there's other parts of their success that they really like, but you know, getting job offers, they're like, oh, we don't want to work with these people. It's like, wow, so funny. But yeah, but what about you? What was your big reaction?
Well, it's just, I think a degree of envy that they lead this romantic lifestyle. Like I think about my friends who like, you like to travel. Like I don't really like traveling. Like I'm a little bit of a homebody. I always envy people who like to travel because I think there's adventure and wonder and there's lots of things you can look at and do when you travel. And I think I look at the way they kind of caravan through the country and make these movies as this similar romantic lifestyle. I don't think I could do it without, I learned this term from Sanaa Soni yesterday. I met up with her from 1091 and former guest of the show. She talked about being moored as in like, I guess it means like being docked, like a ship being docked. And if you're unmoored, you're adrift. And it's like, I really like being moored. I like to I want to more. Like, I don't want to not. That's I don't want to so not more. So I think what I'm drawn to is the spirit in which they make their movies where they developed their own system. But the idea of not having stability scares me. And the idea of not, I don't know financially how they make it work. Like if they're not, if their day jobs are a little bit sporadic, that does make me a little nervous. And it sure as hell would make my dad nervous. Who like every week is like, how are you doing financially, Liz? Do you have a safety net? What's going on? What if you get sick? What will happen, Liz? Like, I couldn't answer those questions if I were in their position.
Yeah. No, they just like live life by the seat of their pants. Yeah. You know, they're just like,
it's beautiful, but not for me.
Yeah, it is a beautiful thing. Yeah. But it definitely seems like challenging in a lot of ways. But it's really cool that like they have this kind of connection with their kids and they're, you know, want to make movies in this way all together. Like, I think it's a really great thing and a really great creative gift they gave their kids to like, you know, have that, you know, interest and then that storytelling expertise at such a young age is pretty cool, you know.
Oh, and I just realized that it came off like super negative and it's like they were like my top five favorite guests like of all time. Like I adore them. Like I think they're so cool. I just, upon distance from the chat, I'm starting to pick out like why I can't do what they do, but I admire them wholeheartedly. And yeah, I agree. Like to raise your children like that is very cool.
It's so funny because during the conversation, Liz was pretty much smiling the whole time, like the biggest smile ever. She was like so in love with them and the conversation. It was like she was in awe of them, you know, which I mean, which makes sense, especially it's like, and they're such great communicators, you know, and they're so confident in their words and in their whole thing that it was just a blast to talk to them. And I can see why, you know, they're doing so well. So it's very cool. Very cool. All right. So we don't have a news piece this week, but we do have this wonderful iTunes review. So let me go ahead and let this one get out into the world. It's a 5-star review. It's titled, "As an indie film studio, this podcast is gold. So I make indie horror movies with my brother at DBS Films. And I have to say, I love these podcasts. I found myself going from the first one to the newest, RIP Timothy. However, Ulrich and Liz do such a great," and I think he meant to say job, but he just said such a great. And then he says, "Excited to see the alternate. Thanks. Can't wait to share it with you." That's from Kellen Rudnicki from the United States. Do you know Kellen at all?
No, this is a verified stranger to me.
Awesome. Me too. I know another Kellen, but definitely doesn't have the last name Rudnicki, unless Rudnicki is a joke name, but I don't think so. Uh-huh. Anyways, Kellen, thank you so much for the very, Kellen, very glowing review. Also, I wanted to talk about something. So the day that we interviewed the Addams Family, we also interviewed Addison Hyman from last week. So we had Hellbender, Addams Family in the morning, and then Addison in the afternoon. And it's like, okay, they both play Fantastic Fest. I mean, granted, Addison played Fantasia, and then Addison, of course, played South by Southwest, and the Addams Family didn't. But like, you know, they're like in the same realm, right? Like, you know, in a realm of filmmaking where they're like making these horror features, and they're getting recognized by the same people, but they couldn't be more different. Like Addison is like this career focused, like I want to direct movies, like I want to direct the X-Men franchise. Like this man is like focused on a goal to like have a career. And then the Addams Family are, you know, not. They're like, we just want to make movies as a family. We want to keep on doing it the way that we do it. We don't want to change our style, and we love it. And, you know, no, we do not ever want to get hired to direct anything. We would not want to make a Marvel movie ever. That would be the worst thing in the world. This is very, very interesting. But it's so funny because they both turned down directing jobs. Like Addison was talking about turning down his like opportunities because he really wanted to write his next movie, which is funny because like if you want to make X-Men movies, like you probably like, wouldn't you want to take directing jobs? I don't know. Maybe that's not a correlation there necessarily. But anyways, so it was just really interesting and made me really think a lot about like here's like two different ways to approach our form. You know, it's like, this is one way where you're like, only for the art. I want to do it my way or the highway. And I don't care about accolades, money, fame, whatever. I just want to keep on making my movies with my family the way I make my movies, come hell or high water. And then it's this other person. It's like, no, like I want to make my stories, tell my stories, but I do want the directing jobs. I do want the accolades. I do want my career to scale up and for me to have bigger budgets and stuff. And it's just really interesting to like hear how those two different people talk about their films, because the conversations couldn't be more different. They were so different, but they're like also like share the sphere of like being at Fantasia. So I don't know if there's anything to really say about that, but it's just fascinating to me.
I think there's a lot to say, but I also feel like both have the privilege of making that choice because of something like Fantasia. Mm. I heard about Hellbender because Joe Bob played it on his show and it premiered on Shudder. And for some reason, I think it's very interesting that we got the publicist email after it premiered on Shudder. Like, that's very unusual. But either way, had the film not premiered on Shudder, had they not gotten into Fantasia, had they not gotten the support of, I think it's Yellow Veil, the company, or prior to that, I think it was MPI, but it's like the support of sales organizations and high prestige film festivals, we wouldn't be talking about them. And they probably would have a much harder lifestyle to bear with this like orthodoxy of what it is to be an artist, right? Like, how are they going to mm-hmm. keep on going when they haven't grown that audience and connected with these gatekeepers like they talked about on the show? And then Addison, it's like, and it's not that they both earned their success, but I'm saying that they have these markers of success that open doors so that they can make that choice. But if neither of them got into Fantasia, most likely representation wouldn't have come for Addison, right? XYZ.
Yeah.
May have less faith or may have less of an investment in him as an artist. And then for the Addams family, they'll be seen as less as of a commodity, right? People invest less of their time in them. So I agree that they have disparate right. paths, but I also think like they kind of have the same roots to get them to that disparity. Right.
They were open. They were welcomed by the gatekeepers in some way. You know, and like, you know, welcomed into this world that not everybody or most filmmakers don't get welcomed into, basically, you know, and which is why they were both pitched to us, you know, for the show.
Right.
It's funny because like that's the second time that a Shudder movie has premiered on Shudder. And then we've gotten a publicist email like weeks to months later and it's for the DVD release. So like that's what happened with Slacks. And that's what happened with this one, too. It's like they're trying to promote the DVD release, but maybe they don't care about promoting the digital release because it's just built in into their own marketing, or they just put it onto their thing and they just see how it does. Like, I don't know what the Shudder, you know, approach is, but it's very interesting for sure.
Well, it's like that argument that physical distribution like Blu-rays and DVDs is still a thing amongst horror. And sometimes with older audiences, with titles that kind of lean towards an older audience, right? But they have not disappeared. And I mean, we benefit, right? Like I tried to get to the Addams Family before the publicist reached out and they didn't respond to us. So we benefited from them wanting to promote their DVD release. So I'll take it.
The last thing I want to say about this is like, you know, what I think this proves, you know, and there's probably other guests that prove this as well, but it's like, we're basically all of us as indie filmmakers, we're like one movie away from like our careers exploding.
You said that last week. Yeah.
I don't know. It popped in my head this morning again. I was like, well, one, it's just one, but I guess whatever. Strike it from the record.
No. It's worth kind of chewing on. I agree. I don't think it even has to be a massive hit. Like, I think it's just like some sort of thing that reinforces you as commercial, as something, as someone that, as an entity or a brain or a talent that's going to make other people money. Like, it needs to be some kind of financial tie-in, I think. I don't think it needs to be, like you said, like a big breakout hit, or you said something like one big successful indie film away from directing a Marvel movie or something. That was like the...
Oh, yeah.
So it's slightly different. But I would say it's even less of a barrier than that. It's like one amazing press release away, one amazing fellowship away,
one film festival.
Yeah, one success away.
Anything.
Yeah.
It's so funny how like, you know, Addison was describing like his experience with managers and you know, whatever at South by Southwest. And I think that's also where he met XYZ. So it's just like, it's like you get into South by Southwest, it's like your life changes. And, you know, and it's just like, it's so funny that it's like that one institution among other institutions that are the same, like it holds that much power of curation in the filmmaking business. You know, it's so interesting to me.
I think it's a nice reminder, though, that we're talking about one type of success. And I'm working with Clinton Cornwell, who listens to the show, and he kind of audits my comments from time to time. And I think it'd be good to just kind of remind ourselves what you also said last week, which is like, we're going to make our movies no matter what. So like, as long as it continues to make us happy, and as long as we find a way to make a living and be creative, then it doesn't matter. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
That's a good point. And it's either going to happen or it's not going to happen. And to some degree, you can't really even control it. You know, this is what's set for you in the universe. And with that, I think that's a good place to end. If you want to add to this conversation and, you know, either agree or denounce our crazy sayings, you can always send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesthishard.com. Or if you really like the show, like Kellen did, you can leave us a review on iTunes, which would be amazing. And finally, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Make sure to check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They are an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through
through a number of programs we offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals. You can go over and check them out at www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to John Adams and Toby Poser for coming on the show, and to Caitlin Flanagan from Falco Inc. for setting this up. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Brian Mooch, for doing the editing, and thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just simply being awesome. Thanks to all y'all for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Hello, Jeff.
I realize that we don't say hello to him enough. We should just constantly say hello.